I think this technology linked with the national security and technological decisions, something intentionally being not to integrate, but to separate, you know, this is not new, you know. But I think from IT perspective, we always say, look, guys, but we all need to have the technology. We all need to agree how it will be kind of working together. We need to agree how it will be interoperate. So at least let's figure out how far we can go with that before there's a divergence happens. We find that standardization part can move pretty quickly because standardization pieces, first of all, is about interested people coming together to develop something.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, the podcast promoting responsible, ethical, and trustworthy AI practices globally. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we are honored to have with us Tomas Lamanauskas, the Deputy Secretary General of the International Telecommunications Union, ITU. Tomas brings truly a unique perspective to AI governance, combining over 20 years of international leadership experience across four continents. Starting his career as a computer science teacher in Lithuania, he's since led telecommunications regulatory authorities in Europe, the Middle East, and the Caribbean, and advised governments in the Pacific, and worked with multinational corporations across 13 countries. His academic foundation is equally impressive, a law degree from Vilnius University, a master's in telecommunications regulations from the University of the West Indies, and an MPA from Harvard Kennedy School and leadership training from the London Business School. Wow, that's a handful. But as the Deputy Secretary General of ITU, the UN's specialized agency for ICTs, Tomas now oversees initiatives connecting nearly 8 billion people worldwide. And he's spearheaded the AI for Good Global Summit that brought together 11,000 participants from 169 countries, which we were very lucky to be participant in, and it was a fabulous conference. Tomas, welcome to the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you much, Sanjay. Thank you very much for this wonderful introduction. You know, I'm really happy you had so many facts in, so thank you much.
Oh, wonderful. Tomas, we were really, grateful to be a part of an incredible conference, which is the AI for Good in Geneva about a month or so ago. For our listeners who are global listeners, policy leaders, entrepreneurs, think tank experts, firstly, could you briefly, especially for people who don't know, what is the ITU? And then how do you see ITU's unique role in shaping AI regulation? And what advantage does a telecommunication-focused agency, UN agency, bring to AI governance? Can you let our listeners know?
So thank you, my Sanjay. And I can immediately a little bit address this aspect also, the telecommunications-focused, you know, in my conversation here as well. So first of all, ITU is the United Nations Agency for Digital Technologies. So we did start quite a while ago, 160 years ago, so double the age of United Nations now. We celebrate 80 years this year. We celebrated 160. At that time, to regulate and ensure cross-border operation of the what was then groundbreaking technology of telegraph. In the recent event, moderator actually kind of read out for audience what electric telegraph is. I was a bit surprised, but maybe I'm geek, you know, so I thought that everyone learns that still at school, but just to maybe for the audience that may not have done that. So electric telegraph, it was basically original way through the wires to exchange information electronically, you know, and sometimes if you hear in the movies, it's beep, 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 beep. So that's the kind of impression of telegraph and Morse code and other things, how people would communicate at that time. So when telegraph was invented, initially it would work only within the borders, and then to make sure it works across the borders. So that's where standards needed to be agreed among the nations. And that's why they set up what was at that time International Telegraph Union, signing International Telegraph Convention. and Paris. So that was 160 years ago. Since then, of course, ITU was always in the forefront of different technological revolutions. I would say what we now would call digital technology, but of course, in that time, there was the digital had a bit of a different meaning still. So from telegraph, we went to the wireless, you know, so maybe simpler to say, you know, your mobile phone needs wireless, you know, so because that's how it connects to the global network. But also your microphone that you use on the stage and is connected by wireless, your, you know, Bluetooth headphones also, you know, use wireless, you know, and everything around the world in this kind of invisible radio waves, you know, that connect all the devices. So ITU started in the early 20th century regulating that, agreeing globally how different radio waves would be used. It's also that synchronization is key because for manufacturers to produce the devices, they need to know that those devices would be used in the same way in different parts of the world. So that was very important. Then we went to satellites. And again, in 1957, the first satellite was launched in space. In 1963, the first conference, what we called World Administrative Space Conference, which is specifically on how to regulate the emerging space sector, especially from radio context. But again, because for the satellites to operate, they need radio waves, you know. But then what we realized as well, that also is not only the radio waves, but also place in orbit so that they can find their own space there. So that is a new technology that, again, ITU had to embrace. And then in the 90s, what was also realized, it's not only about standardization and technological progress, it's about having it available to all. So in the 90s, we added our development arm, which is now called development sector, or which is supported by our Bureau of Development, which is basically focuses on democratizing, if you will, technology, bringing it everyone. And in that moment as well, successive, let's say, waves of technological change, and ITU had to be at the forefront of that, from the internet and all the underlying digital infrastructure to, of course, the mobile revolution that changed the way people connect to the telecoms. But then all the application layer, what we call, and then, of course, now artificial intelligence, metaverse, quantum, and other things. You know, because just to give an example why I'm saying it's not just telecoms and then this AI, the AI piece is not surprising, is because, you know, if you look at ITU history as well, for example, and what we're known for example, video codecs and broadcasting quality. For those, we actually have a number of Emmy Awards. And again, some people don't know that there are Emmy Awards for engineering, and ITU actually is a holder of quite a few of them. And then at the same time, for example, rather famous public key infrastructure, basically the underlying infrastructure for electronic and digital signatures, that's again ITU standardized aspects as well. So I think it's more appropriate these days to say we have a very strong roots in telecoms, and of course that is still a very strong foundational element of ITU, you know, these pipes that bring the additional information around the world. But at the same time, other layers of that technology, applications, the kind of today we're calling also digital public infrastructure, so creating this enabling layer for education, for health, you know, for public services, and then going to these technologies, artificial intelligence, all of that is within the ITU's scope and mandate and activities as well.
Wow. From telegraph to mobile to satellite to now AI. Tomas, AI is moving exceptionally rapidly, probably in talking to a lot of my guests, unlike any other technology. You build standards around telegraph, around telecommunications, around satellites. How is this different? I mean, with something that is moving so rapidly, do you think standardization, and would that stop innovation? Because is it innovation first, standard first? I mean, that's the debate that's at least happening in the US right now. What is ITU's perspective on that?
Thank you, Rich. And again, on this word rapidly, because I think being a 160 years organization, we sometimes have a perspective a little bit different on things, you know? And it's like, we see things like, you know, in telecoms, things. So from one hand, things move very rapidly, different technologies, different generations, different applications. But then submarine cables have been there now for some decades, you know, and they kind of, they are the bulk of how the information is carried. In the same way, AI, you know, we, of course, since ChatGPT kind of brought that to everyone's attention in 2022, we see this rapid revolution. But look, when in my high school, I was learning about neural networks as well, you know, and I was kind of poking around. And sometimes I give this example to people that for now, for a few decades, every time you get a speeding ticket and the camera takes the picture of your number plate and then translates from the picture to numbers, that's AI at work. I mean, more simplified AI than ChatGPT, but this AI is a neural networks. It's a, you know, and the way those neural networks learn how to convert from picture to number is not so different how neural networks learn how to actually produce those different words from the bulk, from the vast amount of information they have, and then numbers. But this, of course, is a scaling loss. You know, much more power, much more computing power is thrown at it, much more data is thrown at it. And of course, now the consumer products are becoming much more accessible. So that is the perspective, you know. So of course, and that's why you didn't start AI in 2022. You know, actually, you know, if you look at our flagship, and you mentioned AI for Good Summit, so the first edition of AI for Good Summit was in 2017. And and the first time United Nations convened the, what we now call interagency working group on AI, which brings UN family together and led by TU and UNESCO, was in 2020. So that's already pretty recent. And then, of course, a lot of other developments and discussions about AI were way before that. So I think having that perspective helps, because having that perspective allows us to distinguish things that really change very rapidly and the things that actually remain relatively stable. And I think there are different layers there. I think standards actually in many ways is an answer rather than a challenge in this kind of fast-moving environment. Because I think the question a lot of people ask, how you ensure that regulation environment, policy environment, governing environment, you know, is that it can adapt to this technology revolution. That's what we learned from telecoms and others, that you have to have this multi-layer governance. That first at the top of it says policies, you know, that kind of where the governments agree on ethical requirements, on consumer requirements, on the technology needs to be brought to everyone. So they're very high level principles, you know. Then there's the regulations that kind of translate those principles into the rules. And then there's the standards that then allow technology to adapt and to be matched to those regulations and policies. Now, sometimes, you know, if you don't do it right, then people try the policy on regulation to codify everything. And then, of course, things don't move very fast, you know, because first of all, it's difficult to agree. And then once you agree, the technology would already have changed by that. So that's why this having that full ecosystem of instruments, if you will, of the way of approaches to govern things and technology and to kind of come together is really useful. We find that standardization part can move pretty quickly because standardization pieces, first of all, is about interested people coming together to develop something, you know, and usually it's a very collaborative way. It's not only just governments, it's the governments, it's academia, it's private sector, it's other stakeholders. And that's what ITU is pretty unique, UN agency in that regard, because we not only have 194 member states, we also have more than 1,000 is what we call sector members. So these means all the other stakeholders that actually have a membership and they participate in that process in a pretty rapid way. And they can iterate, you know, so you can do one standard, you can do another version of standard as technology evolves, and then you can help match that standard development, as I say, to regulatory and policy requirements there. Of course, innovation, look, I think it's also innovation, the cutting edge is done by, you know, by private sector, by research centers, you know, sometimes by governments. And of course, this is there, the cutting edge technology, this is where that needs to be. I think what ITU comes into play as an agency and as a standard development organization, where the technology needs to be available to everyone. Either, you know, both for, you know, commercial reasons, because the companies and others want to expand their markets. And when you have a standard that makes it more acceptable in other markets and also lowers the cost of technology development because of, you know, we can reach more markets, and also for public policy interest, you know, public policy reasons, because you then through the standardization again make the technology more available to everyone. You encourage interoperability, or in the telecoms world we call it interconnection. So that means that different islands of technology can work together. So these worlds like actually drive each other, you know. So we need innovation, sometimes proprietary innovation, to go very fast and bring these new ideas and opportunities. But then standardization comes there to play to actually make sure that innovation can spread and can be adopted by many people.
standardization can be adopted. I think it's very well said. Tomas, do you feel like from a standards perspective, there is not an enforcement mechanism that you have? Do you believe that kind of holds you back? I mean, what is it that you can actually, from a standard standpoint, enforce? I'm talking now AI, et cetera. How do you balance that?
I mean, first of all, ITU is a part of ecosystem, you know, so it's not a beginning or end of all. You know, I think we have a very important role in ecosystem, but we're part of the ecosystem. It's the enforcement role most of the times falls onto national governments, you know, and then national governments can actually have these policy decisions and then enforcement actions to actually ensure compliance. What it do is there is to help those national governments in many ways do the job in a way that actually is not disruptive to the private sector and actually encourages innovation, but then at the same time allows it to the job. So, for example, having a 2 standard makes much easier for the government to regulate, because they don't need to say every time, the government doesn't need to invent a new set of regulations, set of rules, set of standards, quote unquote. The government can say, look, you know, whatever ITU or the standardization body said at this time agreed, that is requirement. And that's been, you know, for a long time, for example, telecommunications quality of service, that was the way. You know, if you look a lot of country regulations, they would simply refer to ITU standard and would say, look, you know, whatever ITU standard at the time is, that's kind of what you need to comply with. And then as the technology develops, so then a 2 standard would develop, and then governments would naturally, automatically, through incorporation or through reference, would dare to say regulatory framework would update. And in a way, that's what the EU and other standardization bodies give it to the broader ecosystem. So give this agreed, most of the time consensually, sets of rules, sets of protocols, mm-hmm. sets of standards, which then different stakeholders can use, whether to incorporate that in the national regulatory frameworks, international or regional regulatory frameworks, or to self-adopt and self-certify, you know, and sometimes, you know, so those players can say, look, this is the standard I comply with. You know, sometimes these standards can be referred into the procurement rules and regulations or contracts. So this is the way to actually move the governance without immediately imposing something, but using that plethora of other, let's say, enforcement mechanisms, whether it's national, whether it's contractual, whether it's other ways. Another piece which is very important, I think, is broader than standards, but it's also like a general our convening power, is the shining the light. And I think the shining the light is also important, because then, you know, when you say to the people, look, this is how some set of people do it, some people, other people do it, through that, you can encourage people to comply with different rules and standards, like what we do with our Green Digital Action Initiative. Mm-hmm. We're bringing stakeholders who say they care about digital industry to be sustainable and contributing to the fighting climate change. And then through that, we then push them to adopt some standards and back up their words with their specific commitments, you know, and then we kind of track that. So while shining the light, you also kind of, you know, self-enforcement, encourage self-enforcement and soft enforcement. And finally, which just sounds the softest out of that, but actually a lot of times it's very impactful, is a place, is a venue, and that's where UN part of ITU comes in, is a venue to kind of agree and signal global values and global principles and global objectives. You know? Because when you kind of signal that and you say, look, the local community is interested in that, it's very often it's not the mere words, because that drives other policy decisions. That drives the national discussions on what are the right policies, that drives discussions between private sector and the government, that drives corporate policies and corporate initiatives from the private sector side, because they want to align with that. You know, like always, you know, the good example is the kind of Sustainable Development Goals agenda, which is kind of, you know, it has a lot of self-adoption, no? So, and if you say, oh, yeah, but this is just a framework, but then you see how many groups of people actually say, no, we want to align in this, this is what you do because of that. And I think the same with all these other discussions is about having those frameworks, and then here, for example, ethical frameworks on AI and discussions about, you know, that, you know, about the environmental impact of AI, they then drive those discussions on different other layers and say, okay, no, we actually need to think about that when we do something nationally or corporate, or the corporate level.
No, so I think you made 3 key points here for our listeners. One is the standards become a guiding light for countries maybe to adopt easily. Hey, they can point to ITU. but then also there is a shining light. So it makes companies or whatever else, stakeholders, hey, are we following these standards? Maybe gives them a competitive edge. And finally, it gives a location or a place to convene the UN, et cetera, for different stakeholders. I think that's a very important perspective, Thomas. Thomas, you said bringing people together, and I don't know in terms of telegraph and telecom. Right now, it seems like there are three centers of AI governance that are developing. The EU has the EU AI Act. The US has basically an America first innovation, and China has more a state-driven AI governance. They just announced that they also want a global governance perspective. Looking at what has happened before in ITU or how you see this kind of groupings, what is your perspective on how this kind of plays out in the mission that ITU has in terms of AI governance and standards?
I think, first of all, that different approaches is nothing very original in a way, you know, because we even have that in a much more narrow telecoms world. You know, we have sometimes, if you look at third generation mobile telecommunications, it was much more kind of regionally based. And before that, just maybe we had a big split between, say, North American standards or American standards and European standards. But then if you look now, the 4G adoption has actually became more kind of integrative. And actually, you know, like we, of course, as ITU, would like to believe that, and we see some examples from telecoms world, the more global approaches, the more successful and fast rollout it is. But at the same time, especially when it's a new technology or a relatively new technology in the policymakers' eyes and then the kind of adopters' eyes, I think experimentation is a very healthy thing to have. And I think it's useful to have these different approaches and to see which one will have its own advantages and which will pursue different environments as well. You know, because I think different cultural environments and different historical environments also drive adoption technologies. You know, like I remember this discussion, and you know, like in Scandinavia and even, you know, Lithuania where I am, you know, we always like to just kind of talk about like where I'm from, like this whole idea about, you know, single IDs, single digital IDs, you know, having the single databases, you know, like, you know, from your health system, you know, your health system connected with your kind of employment system and the driver's license. And you have like this very useful governing system. In some countries that have a bit of a different history, that's a big no-no, you know, like a couple people say, no, I don't want government to know everything about me, you know, whereas in some countries say, no, I actually want that the usefulness of everything, government knowing everything about me so that they don't need to kind of bring that information every time to different government agencies. This is an example from non-AI world that it's not just about like which approach is best, but it's also about like different cultures and different societies have their own different approaches to the technology. I think with artificial intelligence, we are now at that stage. And those different approaches are probably most fitted for the societies that kind of have them. Now, what ITU is there to do, and organizations like ours, is to bring them all together and to allow them to share those experiences, hopefully to see whether there are some commonalities there, so on which we can all agree, you know, and usually we always see that there's some layer there that we all can agree on, and then kind of there's a layer that we can't. Then on the layer that we don't necessarily agree, seeing maybe it's a merit of each other, where we can actually adopt things from each other. And then I think that's what's most important. Then you mentioned three centers, but I think there's a lot of countries that are not in neither. And I think those countries that are in neither, they're actually a lot of times forgotten, especially in this bigger geopolitical discussion. People like I mentioned three centers, and as if this is the world. But a lot of other parts of the world, at least they consume the technology, you know, and actually a lot of them have a right and would like to participate in technology development. So for them, it's very useful to come and hear these different approaches and to understand what's best for them. And it may not be neither of them directly. It could be some combination of elements of all of them to adapt it for their own. And I think that is also a very important role that they play. So for example, when we did, you know, last year, we had our first AI Governance Day at the AI for Good Summit. So this year was the second. So the first year, we basically brought all these different, let's say, agreement groups or convening groups on AI together to share. You know, we said, okay, what does G7 do? You know, what does G20 do? What is what's called Bletchley process? You know, what has been discussed there? You know, what does European Union think? You know, what does the United States of America think? What does China think? And then kind of within that, kind of create that platform for all of them share, understand, and even understand each other. Because a lot of times when we say, and what you said, that we kind of oversimplify as well, let's be open. You know, we kind of see them, see those frameworks in specific blocks, and when we kind of put that in a bit of a stereotypical environment. But when you start unwrapping, you start understanding some of the more reasons, more nuanced reasons sometimes beyond that. And that's where, and then you allow to see the results, allow everyone to brag about results those different approaches achieve. And then you say, okay, let's kind of choose for ourselves what's best, you know, and let's kind of maybe go through these cycles, and maybe at some point we'll start converging a little bit. But I think, but that's kind of where I think the idea of ours is we don't seek to have a kind of global one framework that everyone will have to buy to. We actually try to encourage learning between the different frameworks and different ecosystems. The ecosystems, different groups or different country groups or countries, to say so that everyone kind of has that information to be able to choose for themselves what works best for them.
I think that's fantastic. One question I had is that AI, at least that I'm based here in Washington, the discussion of AI has become more about national security or geopolitical perspective, that, you know, either, you know, you're going to be in one side or another with the ecosystem, there's, you know, restrictions on chip exports and things like that. Did you, I mean, I know there was the GSM, CDMA, the 4G, et cetera. Is there a historical precedence of something like this in ITU's history? I mean, this is, again, you know better, and then how does one deal with something like that?
I mean, this historical precedence or differences is like, even if you look at the history, the reason why railway rails are different width has to do with the national security in some circumstances, and also that enemy couldn't get the same train on your rails when they invade you. You know, so I think this technology linked with the national security and technological decisions, something intentionally being not to integrate but to separate. You know, this is not new. You know. Then these other aspects, so as I mentioned, you said, you know, CDMA versus GSM, kind of standards, but even on the broadcasting, when we started with digital broadcasting and before, you know, we had like a different standards that were not that easy to let's say, combine. So this is kind of difference, divergent technological developments are not new by themselves. I think now they're so visible because the digital technology and AI is so pervasive, you know, because it's not a sideshow, it's not a part of our lives. This is our lives, you know, we kind of live that way. So I think in a way, what we try to do though in ITU and always, we kind of go like, look, we are kind of a global organization. We're not a club of like-minded countries. There are a lot of like-minded country clubs. We're not like a group of like specific industry group that wants to kind of promote specific technology. We're the place when people come to talk with everyone, including those they would not never agree with, you know. So that's kind of when they come to the UN, you know, because this is a place when you totally disagree, you can still come and you can still talk. And that's what ITU's raison d'etre 160 years was, you know. As I sometimes say, even when you fight and you're at war, you still need to have a way to call each other, you know, so to stop that war and to say, like, look, maybe let's stop it now, you know. So I think now with AI, I think that's, again, this is, of course, you know, national security matters, geopolitical matters, which we as ITU don't kind of opine on. This is for every country to have. What we say, can we in all these still agree, and as I mentioned before, on some common principles? Are there still commonalities? And the only commonality can be, for example, that we still would like to be learning from each other. Or then the commonality can be that actually some of the systems need to work to each other, with each other. For example, like internet, no? We can have a very different approaches. What is the freedom of speech in different parts of the world? And what's the balance between freedom of speech and public security? But we all agree more or less that we all want that message to go from one point to another, you know? So, and that was always ITU kind of raison d'etre, you know, that we don't kind of say which kind of value system at the different ends would be, but we say that whatever it is, we still enable people to kind of communicate, and then through, once they start communicating, then they can discuss value systems and everything else on top of that. And maybe sometimes they actually agree quite a bit. Now in ITU, for example, discussion on human rights becoming like rather prominent topic that in the past it wasn't, you know, where people now see how to integrate some human rights aspects in technology. You know? So, but that's because the baseline here is that we need to agree. Like I have another example on submarine cables. that we started working since last year very actively on operational part, and because we saw a lot of breaks. And again, a lot of people saw that as a huge political issue, a national security issue. And again, for ITU to be able to work with that, we had to take it to the notch at the level where it's a joint agreement that we all need that ecosystem of submarine cables to work, because that's how the digital world is connected. And that's why we now have International Advisory Board on Submarine Cable Resilience that has everyone, all the geopolitical powers I mentioned before, has in that body together. And actually, for example, we had the so-called Abuja Declaration. They all managed to agree on it. I mean, on the principle level, and that's why people sometimes are disappointed that UN maybe is not concrete enough. But you see, that's kind of there's the purpose of these frameworks and this ecosystem, to agree what we can agree and then kind of slowly see where the limits are. So for now, and now kind of what happens here, and I think I'm back to this, the newer the technology is and the faster technology moves, everyone wants to kind of capture the benefits of it and see the value of this, and that's natural. You know, there are, of course, some, because the digital technologies are so pervasive, people have some concerns, you know, what that could mean for their lives, if there are some threats or some sort of resilience issues in that technology. So all is very normal. But I think from my two perspective, you always say, look, guys, but we all need to have the technology. We all need to agree how it will be kind of working together. We need to agree how it will be interoperate. So at least let's figure out how far we can go with that before there's a divergence happens.
So you bring at least some semblance of commonality that people can agree on, because we all, whether it is telecommunications, telegraph, or the internet, or AI, we all need it. So I think that's a great point. You very minutely touched on this, and I want our listeners to understand. You talked about undersea cables. Such a vast amount of what the data, even you and I talking right now on this podcast, is driven by the undersea cables, right, Thomas? And why this is so critical that people, and obviously in the past year and so, we've seen some issues that have popped up. So ITU is trying to create some consensus on that too, right, Thomas?
No, exactly. Look, this is like the conversation between you and I now definitely are going through submarine cables, because it's, first of all, different continents. And even if, we were in the same, same continent, you know, it's likely that somewhere something is being transmitted. Actually, 99% of the international traffic goes through the submarine cables, you know, and when the even signal goes up to satellites, still goes back to the submarine cable to be transmitted. So this is crucial infrastructure. You know, on one hand, is a lot of it, 1.7 million kilometers, if you think. But on the other hand, it's just a few, just a little, because it's around 500 of those cables, you know, around the world. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I show the people, I don't think I have it around me now, but I show the people how that cable looks like. You know, it's not like, it's not much larger than my kind of small finger, you know. So, and that's kind of, this is like an infrastructure that we rely on, you know. So, and they break, you know, there's around 200, let's say, breaks a year, you know, that we experience, you know, like around the world. So this is something that we need to kind of take care of, you know. So now, as a community, because sometimes that cable may break in place A, in let's say, you know, Mediterranean or Red Sea, and it can impact a lot of communication between the continents, you know, and sometimes, you know, like between Europe and Asia, but also then because of other things, the different continents as well, you know. So this kind of, this is really have an specified effect. So that the fact that cable broke in your territorial sea doesn't mean that it's only you are affected, you know, like actually big parts of the world can be. So we brought that community together. We brought an expert, it's actually 40 experts plus two chairs, which is a Nigerian Minister of Digital Technologies and Regulator of the communications from Portugal, that they're sharing this, you know, and as I said, a very kind of very inclusive way, because it's also governments from all the parts of the world, the private sector, and others, to kind of agree in the common rules of the world. And we say, like, what are the best, what practices do we need to instill to make sure that those cables can be deployed fast, repaired fast, you know, the permits can be given fast, because some of the things sound very technical, like getting permit to repair, but if that permit to repair takes 3 months to get, you know, imagine how much disruption you have to experience, you know, because that cable is not working for that 3 months, you know. So these things, you know, and because there's only a few of them, if six of them they are cut, and that's not uncommon, by the way, you know, out of that, how much, and especially in strategic locations, how much of that is impacted. You know, we're also looking into better monitoring, basically knowing the data. Data is always a challenge, so that we can take better actions. And also, we're still looking at these white spots, you know, so the countries or territories, especially that still applies to small island developing states, where that that connectivity, submarine cable connectivity, may not be still available. You know, so how to plug that? And we're kind of having working groups that are looking into that. So I think the idea is to really progress on that. We at ITU doesn't come here there as a newcomer. We had a standardization side of it where we've been developing cable standards on the technology side. But now, and most of the cables are based on our technology, standardized technology. But now we kind of moving to more kind of understanding the operational and policy side. And we have great partners there in the name of International Cable Protection Commission, which is an industry body that's also partnering with us on that to make sure that we have a very strong industry perspective in this.
Well, for folks, so that they can correlate why we're talking about this, is just so that you understand, when you put a prompt into ChatGPT, there's a good chance it's going through some of those cables that Thomas is talking about. Thomas, you've spoken at length and with your past about making sure that AI and digital benefits everybody. You talked about AI equity. You work in a place like Palau and other places, etc. And you talked just now about, hey, there are people who don't want to be in these three blocks or whatever groupings we call these. How do we make sure, or how is ITU making sure, whether it is this Pacific Islander nations, their culture? Remember, AI is driven by, the internet is 70% English, Western-oriented culture. How do we make sure that, firstly, they see the benefits of AI, and also their language, their culture, their history, in many cases going back hundreds and thousands of years, also are part of this dialogue?
Thank you, Sanjay. And that's indeed one of the most rewarding parts of my career was spending the time in places like Vanuatu or British Virgin Islands, where you can see how the technology brings benefit to the people in a very direct way. And actually, the more remote the place is, the more impact of technology can be felt very fast, you know, once the technology happens, you know, because, you know, the markets are opened, you know, education, information is opened, and our ability to reach out, the world really kind of makes a huge transformational difference. So it's not only about technology, you know, for us, we see the technology sometimes, you know, like in the city in Washington, D.C., or like me in Geneva, see technology as a kind of improving the way we do, you know, but in some cases, when submarine cable and the connectivity or general internet connectivity is the first introduced in some of the remote communities, this is like transformational for the community, you know, in both good way, because it can open more markets, new information, all others, but also new risks way, because it can open up new risks that their community hasn't dealt with before, you know, like we, you know, like I'm saying for some of the cuts, for example, this internet was a transition from television or radio, you know, and others. If you look at the remote island in Vanuatu, you know, that could be this, that when the telecenter was built and internet came there, that could be the first time the certain kind of information came in, full stop, you know. So, and that's kind of creates a new challenges by itself. But there is this huge opportunity piece. And I think that opportunity piece, as I mentioned, the bigger, the more remote and less the place, the more opportunity it gets when this thing opens. Like we saw that with the mobile phones, mobile payments and others. You know, like for us, mobile phone in many ways was like, okay, additional technology. A lot of people was access to finance, you know, like because of the mobile finance, or access to education, or access to market prices, you know, information. So the same with AI, you know. So I think, you know, the less developed, for example, your educational system is, the maybe more benefit AI can bring. And actually, it's interesting. We have some statistics that in Europe, for example, people more fear of AI, around 2/3 fear of a job losses and other things. Whereas if you look at lower mid to middle income countries, they actually, more people are positive. You know, 2/3 of them say, no, actually, AI will probably improve our lives, you know, and sometimes more even than 2/3, but, you know, improve our lives, you know, provide new opportunities, you know, create better jobs, but also provide new opportunities for health and education. So this is, and I call it opportunity divide, which usually goes opposite, which is so for some reason goes opposite way than other divides. Now, coming to other divides, so means how we bring it. So this is very multifaceted. Of course, infrastructure piece is still important. You spoke and you explained the audience submarine cable's importance. And it's not trivial. I mean, if you don't have infrastructure, which we take as granted, all these fancy apps will not work. And also, so from submarine cables to access technologies like mobile broadband or fixed broadband to data centers, you know, you need to have infrastructure. And you have this huge divide. Still, 2.6 billion of people are not connected, you know, and low-income countries, around a third people only are connected. Imagine, like, if two-thirds of people in Washington, D.C. didn't have a phone, you know, it would be weird, no? So in low-income countries, only a third people are still connected. Now, if you look at data centers, for example, like in Africa, Africa is around short of 20% of the world's population, you know, like nearly 19, I think, exact. It has less than 2% of data centers, you know, so it's kind of the whole Africa, you know. So again, if you look, so 90% of AI compute data centers are owned by from two countries, you know. So you probably guess which those two countries are, you know. So, you know, there's a huge divide in infrastructure. It's then also divide in innovativeness, you know. You have more than 70% of, I think, the patents are coming from two countries as well, you know. So you have that, you have those divides again on innovativeness as well. You have, and then the policy divide, which is kind of interestingly is correlated, you know, because still more than half of the countries don't have the policies, you know, 85% don't have regulations or strategies on AI. But of course, it's correlated because if you're not AI, if you don't understand what AI is or don't have access, it's difficult to write a policy for it. But at the same time, if you don't write the policy, it may not be encouraging your market to develop, you know. So these are the things. So now I think, and then AI skills in a broader system. So I think for ATU, this is like a multi-stack, if you will, multi-layered problem, you know, that we need to resolve. And we're trying to, and that's where being ATU, which comes from additional infrastructure, we're now all the way to kind of applications and technologies like AI is very useful because we have that understanding of the full ecosystem, I would think, you know. So that's why we tackle infrastructure gaps, you know. We assessed, and through our additional infrastructure investment initiative that we run with seven multilateral development banks, that around $1.6 trillion are needed to invest in infrastructure, to bring infrastructure around the world to the same level. And we need to spend it by 2030. And that includes data centers, includes, you know, functional or meaningful, we say, internet connectivity. We'll look at the policy development and our AI governance day and working with others as well of helping countries to understand what the right policies to bridge that policy gap. We'll look at the skills gap. So we have on our flagship AI skills coalition with more than 50 partners, you know, that have a different AI capabilities and now how to push those AI skills to the people. So all these different aspects from infrastructure to skills really to kind of encourage that development. Now, what's very important for us, and that's, I think, again, what shows some of the initiatives, that in ideas, creativity, and enthusiasm is not kind of, it doesn't have the same divide as technology sometimes, you know, like, because so we run these things we call AI Innovation Factory, with startups pitch from all around the world, you know. We run these things called AI machine learning competitions where the coders pitch the ideas from around the world. We have these things we call robotics challenges, or where the high school teams from all the world compete, you know, and program robots, you know, to tackle real life challenges like disaster management. And you see a lot of teams from all around the world. You know, I visited a robotics team in Nigeria, just outskirts of Abuja, you know, like eyes are lit up, you know, eyes are lighting up of these kids when they I nearly said play, but they don't play with those robots because they need the same programming as a big robot we have. They actually resolve real life challenges with robots. You have these examples for Innovation Factory from an entrepreneur from Ghana who uses AI to check crop health, you know, and to kind of address those issues. Entrepreneur from Rwanda who does uses mobile to take pictures and do the preliminary health assessments. So you have these lot of ideas. So what's kind of, and that's why I think concluding it here, that once you bring people tools that we have a bit of a feel joint responsible to do, then those ideas start bubbling up. And then all these other things that you mentioned, you know, language aspects and the relevance aspects starts being resolved because those people are resolving them for themselves. You know, they don't need you to resolve those aspects. They will resolve those once they have tools to do that.
So empower them, I think, is what you're saying. And with connectivity, with data, with skills, I think an ITU plays a key role. concluding on where we began, Thomas, which is the AI for Good Summit, you've been the key force behind what has turned into the largest summit for AI. Tell our listeners, I mean, I was there, it was incredible. Just what is this summit? What are some of the, you know, conclusions, the, you know, the objectives, and what have been the results that have come out of it, and the different aspects, so that a lot of them next year should participate? But it is truly a remarkable conference where actually I got a chance to speak to Will I Am, but anyway, that's a whole different story. So Thomas, tell our listeners about the conference, which is your brainchild in many ways, AI for Good.
Thank you, Sanjay. So this is actually a product of a lot of great people in ITU, and actually started, and I have to confess, before I joined ITU this time, you know, so this means, you know, the first iteration was already in 2017, and some brave people at that time were very foresightful, said, let's start building it. And of course, then the current Secretary-General Doreen and, you know, me being part of the team, I think it was really proud moments to being able to take that as well with the team and actually make that asset even bigger and greater, you know, and it is this. Because I think we were, with this development, we're in the right time. When the AI interest exploded, we already had a very functioning, you know, AI for Good Summit, and then suddenly caught in everyone's attention, you know. And what I think, the few things are important, and I say why people should be there. First of all, it is the largest the UN event on artificial intelligence. And I think that's, so we have 53 UN partners there. It's not just a ITU event. It's actually UN-wide 53 partners event that all come together, all share ideas, all bring their own perspectives. And that's very important, because I think for AI, it's also the event where you start seeing how the power of AI expresses itself, not in the technology itself, but in its application in different areas. You see people talking about AI in agriculture. We just launched an initiative on that. You know, you see people talking about AI in health, people looking at the transport, how AI impacts transport. And you probably saw in our exhibition, you know, some of the new passenger drones, you know. So, you know, people thinking about jobs, you know, we have International Labor Organization really looking into that, how AI would impact jobs and, you know, how we need to adjust in that. People thinking about ethical things. So it's really the broad scope. It all is united because it's UN or conference through that, of course, lens for good. You know, that means how do we leverage that to really improve our lives, improve the prosperity, improve the sustainability, make our lives better, you know, end of the day, you know, like both our individual lives, our countries better. So that, but this angle is very diverse. Now, it also means that it comes, we have a huge participation, you know, so we had, for UN at least, we had 11,000 people this year. Physically, we had 10,000 people connected online. That's, I think, double from last year, triple from the year before. So there's still an exponential growth. That's why encouragement already to book your tickets early, you know, so that you get it, get there and get in place. But also, it's different stakeholder groups. So we had 169 countries represented. You know, we had, you know, we had around 115 minister, deputy minister, head of regulator level, and also really kind of decision makers. You know, we had, you know, different stakeholder groups, academia, private sector, you know, like really from different parts of the world to really engaging there, you know. And then you have through the program, you look at through different lenses, you look through a governance lens, you look from a standardization lens, you look from the solutions lens. And then you actually experience actual solutions in our exhibition floor, you know, like brain-machine interfaces, you know, like, as I said, you know, drones, so like specific other applications down in details, like telecom networks, you know, that you can see AI making a difference. So I think this is the event for everyone who wants to understand how not just to kind of, how to bring that technology together, the policy, and then kind of make an impact for the world at large. And I think anyone who kind of feels that about AI and or any new emerging technology, you know, we had a quantum track since this year, and we probably will continue next. So we're having a bit of a space discussions as well. Should be there with us next year. It's already the dates. So 7 to the 10th of July next year. Here in Geneva, in Polexpo, the biggest conference venue in Geneva. So we hope to see you here, and we hope to really progress that dialogue with everyone and progress that work with everyone to make sure that the AI, as you rightly kind of a few times referred, is not just a kind of this fancy technology that we can talk about few countries in the world that can benefit from that, but the AI power, the positive power, is really felt around the world by everyone.
Yeah, and for our listeners, I have to say it was exceptionally well managed. Geneva is a great city. And Polexpo is, wow, it's right next to the airport. But, this was very different. I've been to a lot of AI conferences, but really, truly AI for good, Thomas. So, Thomas, thank you really for joining us on the Regulating AI podcast. You know, your work at ITU with your cross-regional, especially your work across the world, your experiences, and, you know, explaining why standards are important, why ITU is important, and let's focus on what brings us together, not keeps us separate, I think has been exceptionally helpful, and also talking about AI for good. And for our listeners, just remember that AI regulation isn't just about constraining technology. It's about ensuring that artificial intelligence truly serves all of humanity, from the smallest island states to the largest economies. And that's what Thomas has been talking about. This is the Regulating AI podcast. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and we'll see you next time as we continue exploring how we shape responsible AI governance for our global future. Thomas, this was fantastic. Thank you for taking the time. This was great. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sanjay. Thank you. It was really a pleasure for me to be part of this. Thank you very much.